For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, Jane and Stephen Hawking, Chris Lintott, Marcus de Sotoy, and the boy who played with Fusion. All that and more on today's Read On Science Special. Coming up in today's show, we'll hear about the narration of the book, The Boy Who Played with Fusion. Co-host of The Sky at Night, Chris Lintott, will be talking to Red Sail, and we'll have the books of your life from mathematician Marcus de Sotoy. Plus, we'll hear what new books are entering the RNIB Talking Books Library. But we couldn't have a science show without talking about one of the most famous scientists ever to have lived, the late Stephen Hawking. In the RNIB Talking Books Library, there are books by him and books about him.
Today, scientists describe the universe in terms of two basic partial theories, the general theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. They are the great intellectual achievements of the first half of this century. The general theory of relativity describes the force of gravity and the large-scale structures of the universe, that is, the structure on scales from only a few miles to as large as a million, 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 million. That's one with 24 zeros after it, miles, the size of the observable universe. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, deals with a phenomena on extremely small scales, such as a millionth of an inch. Unfortunately, however, these two theories are known to be inconsistent with each other. They cannot both be correct. One of the major endeavors in physics today, and the major theme of this book, is the search for a new theory that will incorporate them both. A quantum theory of gravity.
A clip from A Brief History of Time by cosmologist, theoretical physicist, author, and star of The Simpsons, Stephen Hawking. It's one of many books by him in the RNIB Talking Books Library, covering everything from the nature of space and time, the universe in a nutshell, and black holes and baby universes. There's also a biography of his life by Kitty Ferguson, and a children's book he co-authored with his daughter Lucy, called Georgie's Secret Key to the Universe.
The comet shot through the asteroids incredibly fast. Another large rock hit the comet just in front of them, raining down smaller rocks on their spacesuits and helmets. Through the voice transmitter in his helmet, George heard Annie scream. But suddenly, the scream went silent. The noise just stopped, like a radio being switched off.
Comets. Comets are big, dirty, and not very round snowballs that travel around the sun. They are made up of elements created in stars that exploded a long time before our sun was born.
A clip from Georgie's Secret Key to the Universe, read by James Good, with science facts read by Stephen Hawking. There's been a lot of interest lately in the life and work of Stephen Hawking due to the film The Theory of Everything, which won the Best Actor Oscar for Eddie Redmayne. It's based on the book Travelling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, by Jane Hawking.
We had scarcely gone 100 yards when a strange sight met our eyes on the other side of the road. There, lolloping along in the opposite direction, was a young man with an awkward gait, his head down, his face shielded from the world under an unruly mass of straight brown hair. Immersed in his own thoughts, he looked neither to right nor left, unaware of the group of schoolgirls across the road. He was an eccentric phenomenon for straight-laced, sleepy St. Albans. Gillian and I stared rather rudely in amazement, but Diana remained impassive. "That's Stephen Hawking. I've been out with him, actually," she announced to her speechless companions. "No, you haven't," we laughed incredulously.
Read there by Sandra Duncan, a clip from Travelling to Infinity by Jane Hawking. At the iWrite Book Festival, I asked her how close the film was to the book.
The film is squeezing 25 years into 2 hours, so they have omitted a great deal. They've changed timescales. They have rolled many characters into one. Stephen's friends are all in one character called Brian. I don't have any friends at all. As I said, I really lament the fact that my parents don't feature prominently in the film. And they've left out a huge amount of material, particularly all the travels that we went on. And that, I think, is a great shame, not even to give any indication of all those travels, because they were a large part of our existence. Mm. But on the other hand, the film is very beautiful, it's very moving, and emotionally it's absolutely spot on.
Did you see the script beforehand, and did you have any power of veto over it?
The script was sent to me to vet on several occasions, but I didn't have much control over it. And really, all that I managed to do was to correct the fact that the New Zealand scriptwriter had described Cambridge University as a campus, which it certainly is not. Nobody ever uses that term when they talk about Cambridge. And also, the script was littered with the F word. Mm. And I said that scientists in those days, scientists now, most university people, simply don't use that word.
Come on, get up.
Morning, Brian.
Stephen, are you aware that you've voluntarily embarked upon a PhD in physics? Hello.
Hello.
Science.
Arts.
I'm a cosmologist.
What's that?
I study the marriage of space and time.
The perfect couple.
One never knows from where the next great leap forward is going to come, or from whom.
What if I reverse time to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
Wind back the clock.
Wind back the clock?
Keep going.
I don't know how.
Yet.
Keep winding!
Where's he?
I also asked Jane Hawking how perceptions of disability have changed over the years.
I think the change has been tremendous, because when I first knew Stephen, disabled people weren't even expected to be out in the streets. Mm. So we got a lot of stares from people who couldn't believe that somebody in his condition was out of doors, either walking up and down or being pushed up and down, and then that somebody in his condition was the father of my children.
Has Stephen helped change perception then?
I would think so, most definitely, because he is now an ardent promoter of all those causes that I worked for so much in the 60s and 70s. And he's very encouraging for disabled people.
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
I want us to be together for as long as we've got.
It'll affect everything.
You don't realise what lies ahead. This is going to be a very heavy defeat.
But I love him. And he loves me. We're going to fight this illness together.
In the film, you, or rather your character, don't seem daunted by the onset of motor neuron disease.
Yes, because I hadn't known Stephen in any other circumstances. Mm. Motor neuron disease struck, well, it had begun to strike, I suppose, even before I knew him. I was very shocked by the diagnosis, but I'd never known anything different.
Now, you mentioned earlier about attitudes towards you and Stephen having children. Is disability a barrier to having children?
I think that's a very tricky question, because I think it shouldn't be a barrier to having a family, but on the other hand, the carer needs a huge amount of help if the carer is looking after the disabled person as well as babies and children. Then that carer does need a lot more help than I had way back in those early days.
Good luck.
Hi.
I'm okay.
So, this black hole at the beginning of time,
Brilliant. Brilliant, Stephen. Well done, Doctor.
He has pneumonia. The only way he will survive would be to give him a tracheotomy. He will never speak again.
Yes, he will.
My name is Stephen Hawking.
It's American.
Is that a problem?
It has been a great joy to watch this man defy every expectation, both scientific and personal.
There should be no boundaries to human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
Thank you.
Sorry, did you say something?
I said, thank you.
Jane Hawking's memoir, Travelling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, or as it's recently been rebranded, Travelling to Infinity, The True Story Behind the Theory of Everything, is available in audio and as an accessible ebook now, and the print version is available wherever books are sold.
Thanks to Jane Hawking. You're listening to a Read On Science special. Now it's time, with Red Sail, to cast our eyes to the sky.
Chris Lintott is an Oxford Professor of Astrophysics and the co-presenter of The Sky at Night. He's also the principal investigator of the Zooniverse, the world's most successful citizen science project. His new book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, Adventures in the Zooniverse, describes the astronomical contribution ordinary people and their computers are making to scientific research.
Andrew Gray is a car mechanic who lives in Darwin in northern Australia. He's also an amateur astronomer, with a collection of telescopes used for stargazing under the clear desert skies. And in April 2016, he was the first person to realise that J23154776-10505990 was a star worth keeping an eye on. Every so often, the star does something odd. It winks, dimming slightly for an hour or two. These winks reveal the presence of something that would otherwise be hidden. They're caused by the regular passage of a family of planets that happens to cross, or transit, the face of the star as seen from Earth.
Chris Lintott narrating his new book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, Adventures in the Zooniverse. Keen to learn more myself, I invited him to the RNIB studios. Chris Lintott, welcome to Read On.
It's wonderful to be here.
For those who don't know about the Zooniverse, can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. The Zooniverse came about as, you know, an everyday solution to an everyday problem. We just had too many galaxies to deal with, which many people face in their lives. In our case, we had images of a million galaxies. And if you want to understand a galaxy, you want to sort it out by shape. You want to distinguish a nice, beautiful spiral like our own Milky Way from essentially those which are just big balls of stars, which we call elliptical galaxies. And you have to do this by looking at the data. We had a student look at 50,000 of these galaxies. He showed that he was better than a computer, but he'd had enough after 50,000. And so without really thinking about it, we put the images online on a website called Galaxy Zoo and invited people to come and help. And to my great surprise, we had hundreds of thousands of people helping in the first day, providing 70,000 classifications of galaxies an hour.
Wow.
And the public turned out to be very good at this. So Zooniverse is a collection of projects like that. We discovered that other scientists studying everything from cells to penguins have similar problems. They have too much data and not enough people to sort through it. And so we have this army of nearly 2 million people online helping scientists and other researchers discover what's out there in their data sets.
So it really is a perfect marriage of technology and human beings.
Yes, there's something nice about the fact that it's the technology that caused this problem in the first place. I think if we want to be slightly hyperbolic about it, for the first time in human history, our understanding of the universe is limited not by how much data we have, how much we can collect, but what we do with what we've already got. And so the same digital technology that caused the problems, that created these large data sets, can solve it by connecting us to crowds of people who are happy to give up their spare time and try and make a contribution.
And reading your book, I was really struck by what a deluge of data there is coming in, just how many observational experiments are going on at the moment, how many pictures are being produced that need to be interpreted by somebody or something.
That's right. I mean, it's true in my area of astrophysics, but one of the great joys of Zooniverse and of writing the book was getting distracted by all the other areas as well. I think the best example of this is my friend Tom, who describes himself as a penguinologist, which is officially one of the world's top 10 great job titles, I think. But Tom is interested in penguin colonies in the Antarctic Peninsula, the bit that sticks up towards South America, and he's interested in the penguins' response to climate change, to fishing, to tourism, and to the presence of scientists like Tom as well. And he used to go every year to the same sites, and he'd stand there and he'd count the penguins. But he discovered that he could buy very cheap hunting cameras designed for lazy hunters in the United States who want to know what's in their backyard. And with a car battery and a bit of jury rigging, these things exist and last throughout a winter, taking images every hour. And so Tom can now see the penguins arrive, nest, interact, and get a much richer sense of what's going on. But there's still only him. He can go around all the sites once a year, come back, change the battery, come back with the memory card. But he comes back to Oxford each year with about 8 million images of penguins. And he still only has one student.
Yeah, which I guess is more pictures of penguins than has ever been produced before.
That's right, and more penguins than you'd expect as well. That team found 1 million extra penguins last year, which they found by the smell. One of the things I do want to make sure people understand, because I got to go to the Antarctic with Tom, and for an astronomer it was a bit of a rude shock. Penguins smell awful. People think of them as little cute cartoon characters, but they're disgusting creatures. Awful, awful things.
The same citizen science is being used also for maritime history and for decoding papyri, I believe.
That's right. We sort of stumbled into all sorts of areas because researchers would just phone up and ask whether our volunteers would be interested in their projects. One of the first ones we did was one called Old Weather, which is a collaboration with the Met Office. I think my American colleagues were a bit confused by the name Old Weather, but of course I think there's something British about caring about that stuff. If you want to understand climate change, you need to test the computer models, which predict what the weather's going to be like. And the best way to test those is to predict the past. And if you can get the past right, that you can be confident that you can predict the future. But we need more records from the past. We were okay for most of the 20th century, but our friends at the Met Office had realised that the Royal Navy for a long time has instructed its ships, literally come hell or high water, to record the weather every 4 hours. And so volunteers went through the logbooks from, first of all, from the First World War, though we've gone back before that now, and rescued all of this weather data. And that was an interesting project because we got the scientific data we wanted. We now have a much better understanding of what the weather was like around the globe in the early part of the 20th century. But the volunteers sort of didn't care about the weather. They got interested in the history of these things and found all sorts of serendipitous discoveries in the logbooks. It's one nice example. Well, we know where a bucket was thrown overboard from one particular ship. No one's gone to get it yet in the middle of the Atlantic. There was a ship which lost all of its chocolate rations on loading, which inspired all sorts of poetry and so on. And then there was this one senior officer who kept popping up on ship after ship after ship. And the volunteers got very interested in this guy and tracked him. And it turned out his only role was to turn up and give medals to people. So he was a morale officer. And they found him hopping around the Atlantic in 1915 and 16.
And this is exactly where the human input comes in so important, because it's those quirky little things that capture the imagination of human beings that might be missed by a sort of bubble sorting artificial intelligence program.
That's right. I think a way to put it is that humans are brilliantly distractible. And I think we know that in our everyday lives. But this turns out to be very useful when you're looking at scientific data. I think there are good examples in astronomy where, for example, the Dutch schoolteacher Hanny van Arkel, who was an early participant in the Galaxy Zoo project, we showed her a particular picture of a galaxy. There was a sort of a blurry spiral galaxy, and an algorithm might, if it was having a good day, tell you that that was a spiral. Hanny noticed there was this blob, this blue blob sitting underneath it, which she called the Voorwerp, which we thought was a technical term, so it's in the literature as Honey's Voorwerp, and it was only later we found out this is the Dutch word for thingy or object. But the Voorwerp turned out to be sort of a galaxy-sized cloud of gas. We end up pointing all sorts of telescopes at it and discovering it was energized by activity around the black hole at the center of the other galaxy. And looking at the Voorwerp has become a way of understanding how black holes like that change and evolve. Honey became a bit of a celebrity on Dutch television. We flew her to a conference of astronomers, and eminent professors lined up to meet the Hanny van Arkel. And so other volunteers started spotting their own Voorwerpen, which turns out to be the plural. You learn all sorts of things in this game. And this is now a new way of studying galaxies. But we didn't even know to look for those things. We wouldn't have asked an algorithm the right question. But because, as human beings, we're good at doing one task and getting distracted, we get that serendipitous discovery sort of for free if we can interact with volunteers this way.
So for any of our listeners who haven't yet taken part, because this is open to everyone, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah.
You know, the only thing we're giving up is a few hours of our time, or maybe even just a few minutes of our time. So how would we get involved?
Well, the easy thing to do is just to go to zooniverse.org and pick a project. We make sure that most of them are tested so that we know that if somebody spends only a few minutes on the projects, then they will be useful. And while they're mostly visual, there are some sound projects. There's a project called Bat Detective, which is run out of University College London, where they have actually volunteer collected audiograms of bat sounds and calls. And the task is to identify both the species, but also whether the bats are talking to each other or feeding or navigating. And it's quite fun to imagine these creatures and to recognize what they're doing in their sounds.
What first got you into the world of astronomy? Were there specific discoveries that you heard about on the news that fired your imagination?
I think I'm quite unusual for a professional astronomer because I grew up looking at the night sky. Most of my colleagues are distractible physicists or mathematicians who've sort of wandered in. But I was a kid who went outside and looked up at the sky. And I think there were a few things that really kicked off my interest. One was the remarkable events when a comet called Schumacher-Levy 9 hit Jupiter, and it was seen on the way in this string of cometlets, which is the word for bits of comet, which I like, hit Jupiter one by one, and the impacts were on the far side as seen from the Earth, so we couldn't see the flash directly. But people had speculated that this would leave a mark on Jupiter's atmosphere, but no one really knew what to expect. Nothing like this had been seen in the few hundred years since the invention of the telescope, and I remember getting my own tiny telescope out in suburban Devon, looking at Jupiter on after the first crash. You could see there was this bullseye, this black eye on the planet. And that was amazing, to have seen an event that was unique and interesting, predicted, and then see the effects really hooked me. And another part of the puzzle was that my school was lucky enough to have an observatory, which was great. And more to the point, they gave the 13-year-old kids who were interested keys to the observatory. So we were trusted with the telescope. We also discovered you could get pizza delivered to the observatory, which was hugely attractive. But just the idea that we'd been trusted with this piece of equipment and we could try to do science with it, I think for me that kept my interest alive through a school science curriculum that's quite dry, quite textbooky, mostly about received knowledge. I was out in the observatory eating pizza and trying to discover something or find something new.
Yeah, real hands-on science. It's,
yes.
And that, of course, led you eventually to The Sky at Night and to working with the great Patrick Moore.
Yes, well, that was the privilege of a lifetime. I, like so many other people, wrote a letter to Patrick when I was a kid, and we corresponded a bit while I was a teenager. I've kept a few of the postcards I got back. My favourite just says, "Chris, yes, haste, Patrick." By the time it arrived, I had no idea what the question was, but he was good at staying in touch with people like this. And I was lucky enough to fall into The Sky at Night as a researcher and then as a reporter and presenter. Working with Patrick was fascinating. He was a larger-than-life character. He was exactly the same off-screen as he was on-screen. But he had this ability to convince his audience that they were going to understand what he said. When Brian Cox or I say we're going to tell you about black holes, I'm pretty sure half the audience says, "Oh, I never understand this stuff." When Patrick says we're going to tell you about black holes, people believed him and they would lean in and listen, and I think we've been trying ever since to try and keep hold of that on The Sky at Night.
It's really got an enduring appeal. It's been running for what, 50 years now?
We're coming up, we're not far off the, yeah, let's see, 55, so we're not far off the 60th anniversary. It's coming up quickly. I think the appeal is that it's just straightforward people talking about their science, and scientists getting excited about things, I think, is excellent. Even if you don't understand why Johnny Nichols from Leicester cares about the plasma atmosphere of Jupiter, you can see him jumping around while the Juno spacecraft arrives. If you don't understand why Anna Horleston from Bristol wants to know about earthquakes on Mars, you can see that she's excited as the InSight probe landed this time last year. I also think astronomy is lucky in that the questions we ask as researchers, how did it all begin, is there life out there, what's the history of the Earth, those are things that everyone's interested in. My research questions are the same things I get asked in the pub. That's probably not true if you're a condensed matter physicist, for example, whereas for an astronomer, I think there is that attention.
And there does seem to be a genuine sense of progress and understanding being made. There are new discoveries being made almost on a monthly basis in the news. We might not necessarily understand them entirely, but it does feel as if understanding is growing.
That's right. I grew up, as I said, as a kid, interested in astronomy and looking at space. And I was a bit wistful, I think, at the time that I'd missed the Apollo landings, because the people of the generation above me talk, and many of your listeners might remember watching that first small step and think of that as the golden age of space flight. Well, we're now in the golden age of astronomy. So not traveling to out into space, but in terms of understanding the cosmos, things are moving very rapidly. One way of seeing that is that this year's Nobel Prize went partly to Didier Queiroz and Michael Mayer, two scientists who discovered the first exoplanet, a planet around a star other than the Sun. We have a project called Planet Hunters, where people can either view or actually listen to the changes in brightness around a star, and you could discover a planet from your web browser. So in 20 years, we've gone from Nobel Prize winning science to something you can manage to do in a lunchtime without any prior training. And I think that gives you some idea of how fast things are changing.
Yes, it's not some poor chap in an observatory praying for a cloudless night.
Oh, they're
anymore.
Still there. Then they share their data with the rest of us. So that's the difference.
From the Sky at Night, you and Patrick Moore and Brian May wrote a fantastic book called Bang, The Complete History of the Universe, which is actually in the R&IB Talking Books Library.
Oh, good. I didn't know that. That's great.
That must have been great fun to work on.
It was fun. It was also, I think, a few publishers lost most of their hair during that process. So it was Patrick's idea to write this book, it's a history of the universe in order. So we start with the Big Bang and we work forwards, which I don't think had been done before. And Patrick recruited Brian and myself. And both of us said that we'd love to help, but didn't really have time. And 2 weeks later, an 80,000-word package from Patrick, typed out on his typewriter, arrived on the doorstep. Now, not much of that is in the book. We used to gather at Patrick's house for the weekend, spend 6 hours trying to find Patrick's cat, which was very important. And then we'd go through and rewrite it painstakingly so that it sounded like all three of us and that it was accurate and up-to-date and so. But we were essentially held hostage. Every time we said we were out of time, Patrick would just threaten to publish his version. And so it was a proper collaborative project. And Bang, I think, is rather wonderful. The only problem with the idea turned out to be that all the hard stuff is at the beginning. So if any of your listeners have got through the first 20 minutes, keep going. You get inflation and quantum cosmology and all that stuff at the beginning of the universe. By the middle, it's planets and aliens and life and all of that stuff. So you've got to persevere through the cosmology.
Your own book, The Crowd and the Cosmos, you've narrated it yourself, which is always lovely to have the author narrating the audiobook copy.
Yes, I have. It was a slightly chastening experience, I think. It's an interesting thing. I was in a tiny studio, even smaller than the one we're in now, actually, for 3 mornings reading it, and it was wonderful to be able to do that. But I did realise, I think, the number of people who listen to the audiobook is so large now. I think if I write anything again, I will think audio first and make sure that what I'm writing is speech, essentially, rather than intended for the page. When somebody did say that the experience of reading the book was like having me on a particularly enthusiastic night out sitting opposite them in the pub and talking and talking and talking. So maybe some of that comes through as well.
Did you manage to keep your hands to yourself?
Oh, definitely not. No, my hands are all over the place, as ever. I've always thought with my hands. And yeah, there's plenty of that in the audiobook as well. I've just learned not to hit the microphone.
As the principal investigator of the Zooniverse, what do you hope is going to be the next great discovery made by what do you...
Well, we normally call... Well, citizen scientist is one word. I'm not quite sure that's the right word. Everyone taking part in these projects is just a scientist to me. On the way here, I had a wonderful tweet from somebody who'd encountered the project and whose 5-year-old wouldn't go to sleep last night because she was classifying galaxies, which I thought was rather wonderful. But the next discovery, well, we've just put new data into Planet Hunters. So I would very much like, and that's from a NASA satellite called TESS, which is looking at the sort of whole sky and looking for exoplanets. So I'd love to have Planet Hunters find a planet in orbit around a star that I can point to in the night sky. At the minute, we mostly know planets around fainter stars, but we're getting to the point where we can find them around naked eye stars as well. So I'd love to be able to, with a telescope, look at a star and say, yes, there's a planet around that discovered by a volunteer. So that would be really exciting. The other thing that's changing is that we have new data coming. So new telescopes were providing ever more data, and we're going to have to get better at sorting through them if we still want to be able to be surprised by the unusual.
I'll keep my ears open for news from the Zooniverse Coalface. And Chris Lintott, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Because of the vast distances involved, when we look at the stars, we are taking part in time travel without any need for a Wellesian machine or Doctor Who's TARDIS. Consider Sirius, which is the brightest star of the night sky and is very conspicuous for several months in each year. It is 26 times as powerful as the Sun and 8.6 light-years away, that is to say, roughly 50,000 billion miles. Its light takes 8.6 years to reach us, so that if we look at it in the year 2000, we are actually seeing it as it used to be in 1999. The pole star, Polaris, which many people, certainly all navigators, can recognise, is about 400 light-years from us, according to the latest measurements. The light we see coming from it right now left Polaris around 1606, and any astronomer there, equipped with a sufficiently powerful telescope, could look at the Earth and see England as it used to be in the time of Shakespeare. The light now reaching us from Rigel started on its journey towards us in the time of the Crusades, and even this is local by the standards of the universe as a whole. We can now study objects that are so remote that we see them as they used to be long before the Earth existed. This time travel is essential for our understanding of the universe.
Raymond Sawyer narrating Bang, The Complete History of the Universe by Patrick Moore, Brian May and Chris Lintott, which is TB16127. The Crowd and the Cosmos is out now in hardback, ebook and audio, and Bang, The Complete History of the Universe is available in Braille and as TB16127.
Thanks to Red Seal and Chris Lintott.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
In a moment, we'll hear about the recording of The Boy Who Played with Fusion. But right now, it's time to turn to Lynn Livingston to hear what new books are in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
As we're talking about science this week, I'd like to tell you of a fabulous new book donated to us by Penguin Random House, Horizons, A Global History of Science by James Poskett.
After over 2 months at sea, Christopher Columbus finally sighted land. Sailing aboard the Santa Maria on behalf of the Spanish crown, Columbus was in search of a western passage to the Indies. Instead, he encountered a whole new continent. On 12th October 1492, Columbus landed on an island he named San Salvador, part of the Bahamas. This was the beginning of a long history of European colonization in the Americas. Like many subsequent travelers to the New World, Columbus was amazed by the diversity of plant and animal life he encountered. He recorded in his diary that all the trees were as different from ours as day from night, and so were the fruits, the herbage, the roots, and all things.
A radical retelling of the history of science that challenges the Eurocentric narrative. We are told that modern science was invented by Europe, the product of great minds like Nicholas Copernicus, Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, and Albert Einstein. But this is wrong. Science is not and has never been a uniquely European endeavour. Copernicus relied on mathematical techniques borrowed from Arabic and Persian texts. When Newton set out the laws of motion, he relied on astronomical observations made in Asia and Africa. When Darwin was writing On the Origin of Species, he consulted a 16th century Chinese encyclopedia. And when Einstein was studying quantum mechanics, he was inspired by a Bengali physicist. Horizons pushes beyond Europe, exploring the ways in which scientists from Africa, America, Asia, and the Pacific fit into the history of science and arguing that it is best understood as a story of global cultural exchange. Challenging both the existing narrative and our perceptions of revered individuals, above all, this is a celebration of the work of scientists neglected by history.
Columbus also quickly recognised the commercial potential of the Americas, noting that there were many plants and many trees, which are worth a lot in Spain for dyes and for medicines. Most alarmingly, the island was inhabited. On landing, the Spanish crew encountered a group of indigenous people. Still believing he had reached the East Indies, Columbus named them Indios, or Indians. Encouraged by the abundance of plant, animal, and human life, Columbus continued to explore the West Indies over the following months, reaching Cuba and Hispaniola. He later returned on three separate voyages, travelling as far as Central and South America.
Horizons by James Poskett is narrated by Sid Sagar and lasts for 15 hours 22 minutes.
For those fans of the Donna Leon Commissario Guido Brunetti books, Penguin Random House has donated the latest in the series, So You Shall Reap.
On a Saturday in early November, Guido Brunetti, reluctant to go outside, was at home, trying to decide which of his books to remove from the shelves in Paola's study. Years ago, some months before the birth of their daughter, he had renounced claim to what had been his study so that their second child could have her own bedroom. Paola had offered his book sanctuary on four shelves. At the time, Brunetti had suspected this would not suffice, and eventually it had not. The time had come for The Carl.
A hand has been seen in one of Venice's canals. The body is soon found, and Guido Brunetti is assigned to investigate the murder of an undocumented Sri Lankan immigrant. Curiously, he has been living in a garden house on the grounds of a palazzo owned by a university professor, in which Brunetti discovers books revealing the victim's interest in Buddhism, the revolutionary Tamil Tigers, and the last crop of Italian political terrorists active in the 1980s. As the investigation expands, Brunetti stumbles over something that transports him back to his own student days. This causes him to reflect on lost ideals and the errors of youth, on Italian politics and history, and on the accidents that sometimes lead to revelation.
He went to the kitchen and returned with one of the paper bags the city distributed to hold paper for collection. He opened it and lowered the Prousts carefully inside, then returned to the shelf carrying the bag. He set it beside him, knelt again, and glanced more carefully at the remaining books, making a series of visceral judgments, adding the books to the bag without bothering to give them the opportunity to plead for their lives from the temporary safety of Paola's death.
So You Shall Reap by Donna Leon is narrated by David Sibley and lasts for 8 hours 20 minutes.
Customer favourite Jane Fallon has recently brought out My Sweet Revenge, which Penguin Random House have shared with us.
I want to make my husband fall back in love with me. Let me explain. This isn't an exercise in 50s wifeydom. I haven't been reading articles in old women's magazines. 20 ways to keep your man. That couldn't be further from the truth.
This new book is a dark comedy of love and revenge. I want to make my husband fall back in love with me so I can shatter his heart. I want it to hurt. Paula has had Robert's back since they got together as drama students. She gave up her dreams so that he could make it. And now he's one of the nation's most popular actors. But Paula's just discovered he's having an affair. Now she is going to break his heart like he broke hers. It will be her greatest acting role ever. Revenge is sweet, isn't it?
Robert is sitting at the breakfast bar in the kitchen while I cook. Oblivious. Nose in his phone. Thumbs tapping away at the keyboard like a teenager. Probably texting her. He has no idea that I know. He looks like the same person. The person who yesterday was just my husband. The man I've been married to for 18 years. Today, he's someone who is cheating on his wife. I find myself staring at him, trying to look for telltale signs. How could I not have known? He looks up and smiles. What? What have I done?
My Sweet Revenge by Jane Fallon is read by both Bea Holland and Aisha Antoine and lasts for 11 hours, 22 minutes. Thanks, Lynn. And talking about books available from the RNIB Library. Available now in audio from RNIB is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clines.
Propulsion, the 9-year-old says, as he leads his dad through the gate of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. I just want to see the propulsion stuff. Situated next to the Northern Alabama complex, where NASA engineers designed and built the rockets that propelled America's space program, the center showcases the world's most impressive collection of high-flying hardware. Visitors can touch the scorched Apollo 16 command module, tumble spin in a chair that mimics the frictionless vacuum of space, or command a mission in the space shuttle's cockpit simulator. But Taylor Wilson mostly wants to see the museum's prize piece, the massive Saturn V rocket that launched mankind to the moon.
A new book available from RNIB Talking Books is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clines. And the person who read that for RNIB is Paul Butchard, and he joins me now.
Hi there. How you doing?
Tell us about The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
It's a phenomenal book. I didn't know about this young man. It's about a boy. He's now a young man of 21, but his name is Taylor Wilson. And he was born and raised initially in Arkansas, just near the Texas border in Texarkana. And he's extremely bright, and so is his younger brother. But what happened is that when he was about 10 years old, his grandmother took him to the bookstore. He'd already wanted to be an astronaut, and he'd already figured out everything he needed to know practically about rocket mechanics. He was shooting off rockets, making his own rockets. He knew he'd been to visit NASA and the, where the Saturn V rocket is in Huntsville, Alabama. But his grandmother said, well, let's go and get you a book for your birthday. So he bought a book called The Radioactive Boy Scout, which is a story about a guy called Han, who ended up trying to build a nuclear reactor in his shed in the backyard. And it went horribly wrong for him. But Taylor, instead of thinking, oh, that's a terrible thing, thought to himself, actually, I could do that. And I'm a lot more safe-minded than he is. And so he just became obsessed with nuclear fusion technology. And nuclear fission is what's normally used, where you split atoms. Mm. But nuclear fusion is where you take two very, very light atoms, like hydrogen, and you shoot them with a lot of neutrons and try and make two hydrogen atoms fuse into helium. And they make a new helium atom, which is just a little bit heavier, but it lets off quite a bit of energy when they do that, when the two fuse together. Anyway, The Boy Who Played with Fusion is an amazing story about this kid, Taylor Wilson, growing up initially in Texarkana in Arkansas and becoming, by the age of 14, the youngest person ever to create a fusion reactor and achieve nuclear fusion. And he didn't stop there. He's 21 now.
He did actually achieve it then.
Yeah, he totally achieved it by the time he was 14 years old at the University of Nevada at Reno. His parents took him eventually from Arkansas to a high school in Reno, Nevada. That's north of Las Vegas, near Lake Tahoe in Nevada. And it's called the Davidson Academy. And at that time, the kids who were there were encouraged to just follow their passions. And then they were kept online and on stream for the rest of their studies, but they were allowed to go as far as they wanted in their own passions. So he was taking university advanced higher nuclear physics, and he had two great mentors at the university who were nuclear physicists and one guy who was also a terrific scrounger of materials and builder of stuff. And Taylor designed and with their help got this thing built and machined and built, a small fusion generator right in the basement of the University of Nevada Reno Physics Department.
Now, it's nonfiction and it's a science book. Did that make it quite difficult to read?
Well, there is a lot of scientific stuff in it, but a lot of it's tongue-in-cheek, but it doesn't talk down to you. I mean, it is an interesting book and you have to really concentrate. And it took a lot to read it, actually, because he writes a lot of long sentences, which I had to break up in little bits so that I could be sure I understood what I was talking about. But yeah, it's a terrific book. I really would recommend it because he doesn't just tell this boy's story. He tries to extrapolate it into the fact that really, as we now know and as research has found out, just about everyone can actually excel in some area or other, and some in many areas. So he is an extraordinary young man, but he's not by any means alone. And it's about the philosophy and the sorts of things that societies need to do to allow their best and brightest and their apparently average to excel, to find what they love and to excel.
There's something about your accent. We're recording this in Glasgow. We're in the Glasgow studios. How did you end up here?
Well, I'm the only actor who ever left Hollywood, based himself in Glasgow, and lived to tell about it. And I won't tell you the long story, but the short story is that I was on a picture with Roy Scheider, the late Roy Scheider from Jaws, about 10, 12 years ago. And another guy and I were on it, and Roy turns to us and says, "One of you two guys lives in Glasgow?" And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he said, "Why?" So I told him, and he said, "Yeah, but come on." So then I said, "Well, then I met a girl and fell in love." "Ah, the plot thins." So I'm still here, but I mostly work in London and around London. But when I'm in Glasgow, I'm very fortunate that the RNIB, who do produce talking books here in Glasgow, call me and offer me wonderful things like The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
Okay, give us a bit. I believe this is about a nuclear warhead gone missing.
Yes, and there are many of them, apparently. I'm going to read a little bit from the book here so you get a flavor of some of it. As the strategy of nuclear deterrence catalyzed a frightening, paranoia-driven arms race, the bombs got bigger and more numerous, and the number of broken arrows, incidents in which nuclear weapons were accidentally lost, began to grow. A lost nuke is unsettling enough. Even more unsettling is the fact that it happened so often that the armed forces actually needed to coin a term for it. Now, what Taylor did is he wrote away to the Department of Defense and so on to get reports under the Freedom of Information Act as to where any of these incidents might have happened. And then he would go out and digs for bomb shards and anything else. He just loves nuclear stuff. So he's reading through this this one report. One night, while Taylor was reading through a partially redacted Pentagon accident report, he came across an incident that stood out for its disturbing similarity to the absurdist fiction of Dr. Strangelove. What also stood out was its location. Taylor immediately picked up the phone. "Carl," he said, "there's a broken arrow right in your backyard." And then finally, according to the cleanup report, the crater was filled and the contamination completely removed. "You kind of got to read between the lines," Taylor says. "Completely removed means something like, we bulldozed most of the stuff into the crater, covered it, and then took a cursory look around. Unrecovered means they decided it wasn't worth the effort."
The Boy Who Played with Fusion. By the age of 11, Taylor had mastered the science of rocket propulsion. At 13, his grandmother's cancer diagnosis drove him to investigate medical uses for radioactive isotopes. And at 14, Wilson became the youngest person in history to achieve nuclear fusion. At the age of 17, Wilson is winning international science competitions with devices designed to prevent terrorists from shipping radioactive material into the US. How could someone so young achieve so much? And what can Wilson's story teach parents and teachers about how to support high-achieving children? In this book, science journalist Tom Clines follows Taylor Wilson's extraordinary journey. The Boy Who Played with Fusion will delight anyone who believes in the ability of gifted children to change the world. And as we've said, it's available in audio from RNIB libraries. And Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
Marcus Desautoy is a TV presenter and professor of mathematics. He spoke to Red Sail about his book, The Creativity Code, and he also gave him the books of his life.
Marcus, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, there was a book that made me fall in love with writing mathematics, interestingly, which was a book my teacher at my comprehensive school recommended called A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy. And this is a book written by Cambridge mathematician, first half of the 20th century. What was so magic about this book is that it described what it's like to be a mathematician and, in particular, how creative a subject it is, that he believes it's a creative art, not a useful science. And I think that book made me realise that being a mathematician, I could fuse both my passions, my passion for science, but also my passion for the arts.
A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy has recently been republished and is available in paperback and ebook wherever you buy your books. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, a book that has been with me for many years since I read it as a student is The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse. And this is a beautiful, kind of futuristic story about a game that people play. And the game fuses kind of ideas of mathematics, music, philosophy, history. And I think that book, sort of the glass bead game, this game, I think that's the game that I've been trying to play ever since I've read that book, because, you know, my whole life is about trying to create new mathematics, but to perfuse that into a richer world of music, art and philosophy.
No knowledge has come down to us of Joseph Knecht's origins. Like many other pupils of the elite schools, he either lost his parents early in childhood or the Board of Educators removed him from unfavorable home conditions and took charge of him. In any case, he was spared the conflict between elite school and home, which complicates the youth of many other boys of his type, makes entry into the order more difficult, and in some cases transforms highly gifted young people into problem personalities. Knecht was one of those fortunates who seem born for Castalia, for the order, and for service in the Board of Educators. Although he was not spared the perplexities of the life of the mind, it was given to him to experience without personal bitterness the tragedy inherent in every life consecrated to thought. Indeed, it is probably not so much this tragedy in itself that has tempted us to delve so deeply into the personality of Joseph Knecht. Rather, it was the tranquil, cheerful, not to say radiant, manner in which he brought his destiny and his talents to fruition. Like every man of importance, he had his daimonion and his amor fati, but in him, amor fati manifests itself to us free of somberness and fanaticism. Granted, there is always much that is hidden, and we must not forget that the writing of history, however dryly it is done, and however sincere the desire for objectivity, remains literature. History's third dimension is always fiction.
Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB library and commercially as an audiobook narrated by David Kalachi.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've fallen in love recently with the books of Robert McFarlane, and who hasn't? But I love walking, but I've never thought reading books about walking. You know, I love being out in nature, but these books, and in particular the one I would choose is Mountains of the Mind, I think it's called, because this really tells about our obsession for climbing mountains. And it inspired me last summer to go and walk in the Alps for the first time. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm 53 years old and I don't quite know why it's taking me so long to go walking in these extraordinary landscapes. So I would like to thank Robert for inspiring me to go up and be amongst those incredible mountains.
There were books everywhere in the house. My grandfather had not tried to organise them, and so very different books found themselves neighbours. On a small shelf in the dining room, Mr. Crabtree Goes Fishing, The Hobbit, and the fireside omnibus of detective stories shared space with two leather-bound volumes of J.S. Mills's System of Logic. There were several books about Russia, whose titles I did not properly understand, and dozens about exploration and mountaineering. One night, unable to sleep, I came downstairs for something to read. Against one side of the hallway was a long pile of books lying stacked on their sides. Almost at random, I pulled a big green volume out from halfway down the pile, like a brick from a wall, and carried it to the sunroom. In the bright moonlight, I sat on one of the wide stone window ledges and started to read The Fight for Everest. I already knew some of the details from my grandfather, who had told me the story of the expedition. But the book, with its long descriptions, its 24 black and white photographs, and its fold-out maps bearing unfamiliar place names, the Far East Rongbuk Glacier, the Zongpen of Shikar, the Lac Polar, was far more potent than his account.
Mountains of the Mind by Robert McFarlane is narrated by Simon Bubb. And thanks so much to both Marcus de Sotoy and to Red Sail. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back with more book news, reviews and author interviews at the same time next week. Or if you can't wait that long, there are over 300 episodes in the podcast feed. Just search for R&IB Read On in your favourite podcast app. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at talking_books. That's it. Until next week. And remember to read on.